Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Biden is scheduled to give his not State of the Union address tonight. But it was yesterday's pronouncement as it pertains to mask wearing that probably garnered more attention than he will garner this evening. President Biden making the seminal announcement.
Starting today, if you're fully vaccinated and you're outdoors, you need, and not in a big crowd, you no longer need to wear a mask.
Yay!
I want to be absolutely clear. If you're in a crowd, like a stadium or at a conference or a concert, you still need to wear a mask, even if you're outside.
Not in Texas.
What
if Florida.
Yeah. Not in Utah. What if we don't wear a mask? Mr. President, are you going to come and get me? I'm right here. I'm in West Lakeview.
So I hope that this was transmitted to the ham radios that the face diapered troglodytes use. To send them word from civilization that it is okay to gradually reacclimate yourself into humankind for all the as momentous as that announcement was. I mean, what did I say a couple of months ago? The CDC and this administration is in the business of making announcements about changes that the populace has already made.
Exactly. I mean, do they not know how 42 states live? I mean, you're in Florida, or when I go to Utah, people, they haven't been wearing masks outside ever. Not just when this started, but never. It was just for indoors. And this is not, you guys, this is a guideline. This is not a law.
Well, right. And,
yeah, but
and
people some, don't know some, that, Dan.
And some people wear masks outside and they will continue to. Fine. I don't care. I care if you wear a jester's outfit outside or inside. You wear whatever you want. Oh. But the understanding is the key. The understanding that it is mainly performative or it is mainly to assuage whatever irrational fears people have. Hey, if you want to live in irrational fear, that's fine. That's not my responsibility.
It makes me claustrophobic. And then it's influencing the younger people, our next generation, that you don't care about America, Dan, if you're not wearing a mask outside while you walk your dog. Because that's what it is. And people are still wearing masks. I still drove down Southport yesterday. Which is shocked. And it's 83 degrees out. And some people are wearing two masks. Now, maybe they might think that they mightn't have, or they're waiting for a COVID test result to come in. That's what I keep to process this craziness. So that we can survive in this world, but I'm just worried about the message.
It's not processing it. It's, you know, to take care of your own household. I mean,
I am, and it's my they're bleeding into my household because my kids are mask enthusiasts now. Mom, it's not up over your nose. Can you please stop embarrassing me? Put it up over your nose. That's what's going on here.
Well, then
they need to spend a weekend with you.
Apparently. But, I mean, look, You just can't get to people. I mean, how many times do we have to say this? I know I'm a broken record on this, but you can't get people to a place of reason if they didn't come to their position from a place of reason. And so that's what you have with some segment of the population. Okay, it's fine. There's no need to send them to a gulag. You can walk around with your mask. You can walk around with two masks because, hey, if you like one mask, had two is even better, says Tony Fauci. Okay, fine, whatever, fine. But the important thing is that the prevailing wisdom, what we know to be true, wins the day. And frankly, what we've known to be true with respect to transmission outside for the better part of the last year. And of course, the government is a laggard when it comes to all things rational, particularly a government dominated by leftists, as are the cultural and civic institutions dominated by leftists. They'll be the last ones to relent because this has been so beneficial to them financially and politically.
Yeah, but why now? And that's what, you know, Lester Holt had a one-on-one with Dr. Walensky. You know, why now? Why not last week or why not a month ago?
Right. What we're really looking for both is an increase in the number of vaccinated people and a decrease in the number of cases. While we're really encouraged by the ongoing trends right now, I do want to remind Americans that we had a 7-day average of about 54,000.
So they're doing it now because more people are getting vaccinated. And this isn't about masks, Dan. This is about forcing people to get vaccinated, I think.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what Joe Biden used the occasion of saying. Yeah, but it can't be outside at a concert or stadium, can't be in large groups. But this relaxation of the mask guideline is all the more incentive.
For those who haven't gotten their vaccination yet, especially if you're younger or think you don't need it, this is another great reason to go get vaccinated. Now.
And part of this performance art yesterday, I mean, he's such a twat. He comes out in a mask and then he puts on his sunglasses and he walks off without a mask on, like, oh, this is a pivotal moment in America. Did you see that? I mean, I was throwing things at the TV. Oh, my God.
Yeah, Peter Alexander from NBC News asked him about
it. Oh, he did.
And you chose to wear a mask, sir. You chose to wear a mask. You chose to wear a mask as you walked out here. What message were you sending by wearing a mask outside alone?
By watching me take it off and not put it back on until I get inside.
Oh, and the Oscar goes to President Joe Biden. Oh, God.
Greg and LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? You guys, Amy, point your children, your two sons that I know you love and you treat as great as you can and you protect with your life, to the girl that was running track, the 800 meter distance run in Oregon, where she wore a mask and she passed out at the end of the event. You know, this is what's ridiculous. Okay. This is what's ridiculous. Some people choose not to get the vaccine because they may not die if they get the disease. They may be asymptomatic, and they don't want to take the shots because maybe they want to see this stuff play out a little bit more because it's emergency use authorization. You're not required. It's not mandated, okay? So let's be clear about that. There's never been a direct answer about whether or not people afterwards can transmit the virus with the vaccine. This is what's happening here is you're segmenting people. You're creating social credit scores right now, and they will invariably force everybody to get a vaccine, whether they're at risk or not. And I don't see how this is anything but a control and a fear and just controlling people. It's completely wrong. We're destroying businesses. We're destroying families. We're destroying the church. We're destroying law enforcement. And for what? For what?
Thanks for the call, Greg. Here's the breaking news here. Well, President Biden thought he was making a momentous announcement yesterday.
He looked like a fool in many states.
The announcement is this, and it was made, again, by Dr. Roger Klein, the former head of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, on our show yesterday. The pandemic is over. In this country, the pandemic is over. And guess what? The politicians always at the back of the parade. Most of the country is behaving like the pandemic is over. Dana White, who's the president of the Ultimate Fighting Championships, he was on with Hannity the other night, and he had this to say about his business.
Just Saturday night, we had 15,259 fans there. If you wanted to wear a mask, wear a mask. If you didn't want to wear a mask, you didn't have to. Everybody was there. The crowd was explosive all night. It was a great show. We broke the arena record, and what that tells me, I sold out Jacksonville, going to Houston next, then Vegas. 50,000 seats sold out in under 5 minutes total for all three. People are done. People are done. They're done being told where they can go, what they can do. They're ready to get back out there and start enjoying their lives again.
Yes. And Tom Brady was there too, so That's where Jacksonville.
That's where it's at, though.
Right.
What Dana White said, that is where the country is at. Not the politicians.
Except for blue states.
Not the champagne socialists. Not some of the fear-addled devotees of the champagne socialists and the politicians. But the country, that's where it's at. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The mayor of Baltimore is a young black man named Brandon Scott. He's 37 years old. He recently gave an interview to Michelle Martin, who I guess serves as a correspondent for Christiane Amanpour and Company. Yeah. But anyway, it was interesting because it was fairly lengthy. And I think it's good to have some comparisons. What's happening in Baltimore versus what's happening in Chicago, New York, L.A., a big city America. And, you know, Baltimore, 2.3 million people.
Wow.
And Baltimore has a crime problem. Baltimore is considered one of the most dangerous cities in America. And yet, just to give you order of magnitude, you know, let's pick up our heads and let's look around the country a little bit here in Chicago. So Baltimore has about 20% fewer people, but it has 266% less murders.
Than Chicago.
300 plus murders last year in Baltimore, 2.3 million people. 700 plus murders in Chicago, 2.7 million people. That's how violent Chicago is. That's how much Chicago has been given over to street criminals.
They're out last night. You can hear them. I'm like, those aren't fireworks.
But listen to what Brandon Scott says about his holistic approach to public safety. You're going to hear this again and again. You've heard it, threads of it from Lightfoot. But it hasn't been laid out. She hasn't laid it out quite like he did.
This disease known as gun violence has been plaguing the city longer than I've been alive. You can't just think that you're going to police your way out of these problems. And I think that's the kind of leadership that I'm bringing to the mayor's office here. That's why I created the mayor's office of neighborhood safety and engagement and embarking upon Baltimore's first of its kind comprehensive violence reduction framework plan. We're going into the community, asking the community how we should work together to reduce violence. 63%, Michelle, of the guns that we recovered last year in Baltimore came from another state, but not until we are now forming and we have a first of its kind gun trafficking data portal that we're now going to have a unit of folks who are targeting these individuals who are straw purchasing and bringing guns into our city. But we're also going to expand the great work that we have here in Baltimore with our Safe Streets Violence Interrupters, where we take people who used to be involved in shooting people, and now they're interceding in that violence. We're going to make sure that we are pushing towards a world-class 911 diversion program where we're going to be sending healthcare professionals and mental health professionals out to help not police officers or firefighters out when folks call 911. And if any city in the country can get that right, the city that has Johns Hopkins Hospital can get it right, because every single city agency plays a part in reducing violence, not just the police. We have to invest in communities, invest in the promise of our young people, not just their failures.
So, I mean, there's something in there that may have some merit, these violence interrupters that's shown some promise in other cities, including Newark, and in pockets, even in Chicago, you know, essentially ex-street gang members go out and serve as peacemakers. But everything else, what did you hear? Blaming other states, the influx of guns, straw purchases. What did you hear? Investing, meaning more public spend in particular neighborhoods and reimagining, talking about different responding officials for a mental health crisis or a drug overdose, not the police or fire department's jobs. And generally speaking, here's what he's getting at.
Well, it is about reimagining. We have to treat violence and crime like a public health issue. That requires reimagining what public safety means and how we think about and govern public safety. That's why we have, that's why I created the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. That's why our health commissioner is who led the development of our violence reduction framework, because we're treating it like a public health issue. For some people, though, Michelle, that's scary, because they don't think that people who look a certain way, black, brown, poor people, should be treated like them. They think that they should be policed and gathered just to protect their way of life. And what reimagining is going to cause, not just my city, it's going to cause this country to do, and the world, even maybe, is to think and be uncomfortable, being comfortable about where you stand, how systems work, how we govern. And that's going to cause people a lot of stress, because we know change is hard. But the reality is, Michelle, we can't continue to do it the same way, because it hasn't worked.
Hmm. You get that? That this is a public health problem. And if you're uncomfortable with treating people committing acts of violence as a public health problem, then you're uncomfortable because you don't think black and brown and poor people should be treated the same way as you or white people. You think they should be policed. You think they should be rounded up. You know, that was very room temperature, and he's a well-spoken guy. But it was not dissimilar to the race hustle you'll hear out of blowhorns from Sharpton or Flager or Jackson. It's just a more mature presentation of it, isn't it? Do you want to treat violent crime as a public health problem? What do you hear when that phraseology is used? Treat it as a public health problem. And if you don't want to treat it as a public health problem, then essentially you're a racist. You don't think brown, black, poor people should be treated the same as white people. That's what he said.
How do you think it should be treated as a public health matter? I mean,
what is he saying?
What is he saying?
And what is he and what are other politicians? You hear the same thing from Triple Threat.
Right,
you'll hear the same thing from Jelly Belly. You hear the same thing from all the big city Democrat socialist mayors and blue state governors. What do they mean? Is that translating in your mind? The, you know, Orwellian speak they're always using, including when it comes to violent crime, crime in general and violent crime. You have to understand what they're doing, what they're advancing here. Oh, and by the way, just in case there's any confusion about my characterization of him as a more buttoned-down version of the race racketeers.
Operate through a lens of racial equity, because, of course, East and West Baltimore are having the issues that they have, when not only did you determine that they could all only live here and basically be poor here in the same neighborhood, but then intentionally their neighborhoods were disinvested in. We went from the time I was born until the time I was 28. I was 28 and on the city council. And that was the first new school that we built in the city. And we've done a lot of that renovation since then. But that matters. When you look at the history of the city's capital budget, right? Not just the operating budget, the capital budget. The capital budget historically goes to our rich white neighborhoods, not our poor black neighborhoods. We're going to flip that on its head.
Mm-hmm. The Marshall Plan for the West and South Sides of Chicago. How many times have you heard that phrase? Same idea. Go ahead and flip it on its head. You know, the problem that Brandon Scott and Triple Threat and all these mayors have with this line of argumentation is, as I've said before, and I will say again, the sides of Baltimore that he's talking about, the sides of Chicago that we're talking about, they are wholly owned subsidiaries of the government. They're wholly owned subsidiaries of Democrat socialist controlled government for 50 years, 100 years. All of the means of production or and the sustenance for life is provided by the government to a large majority, a large swath, I won't say a large majority, but a large swath of the populations in those neighborhoods. Your housing, your food, your income in some cases.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
They also have a problem when you start looking at per pupil spend in schools in big cities as compared to outlying suburbs, much less private schools, when you want to talk about investing in the success of our young people, not their failures, and so forth. These are the throw money at it people. That's problem solving. That's what hasn't worked for 50 or 100 years, Mayor Scott, Mayor Lightfoot. Oh, and just another parallel. So you understand, this is a model that's being replicated around the country and why big cities, who I suspect, will continue to depopulate, with Chicago leading the way. I mean, again, Chicago, lowest population level since 1920.
Congratulations.
We're 75% of what we were in terms of population in 1950. Brandon Scott on Marilyn Mosby. Remember Marilyn Mosby?
Oh, I remember her.
His relationship with Marilyn Mosby. Marilyn Mosby, like Kim Fox, both George Soros-funded non-prosecution prosecutors, going the same direction, not going to prosecute drug crimes, not going to prosecute prostitution. What does Brandon Scott think? They're aligned.
And on the other hand, the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, has said she's already stopped prosecuting certain quote-unquote low-level offenses like drug possession and prostitution, for example. Do you agree with that decision?
Well, what I'll say is this. The state's attorney and I share the opinion that people who have substance abuse, people that are in sex work, aren't inherently criminal. And what I will also say, Michelle, is that we have years and years and years of data here in Baltimore that arresting them did not make our city a less violent place. But what we have to do, the important work now, is for us to, how do we get those individuals the help that we need? But also, we can still enforce those laws. Our police department can still enforce those laws and figure out creative ways to not have people ending up in jail. But we have to build the systems on how to allow those individuals to get the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. It starts from a place of assuming that all people want the same things you want, not necessarily. Number one. Number two, this is a public health problem. Guns are a public health epidemic. Violence is a public health problem. That's how it needs to be viewed. That's just a fancy way of dressing up the victimization argument.
I mean, I'm reading her tweets right now, Marilyn Mosby. 2 days ago, she said too many black people have been killed, either being targeted for low-level offenses, including passing a counterfeit bill, running from law enforcement, and having an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. That is not why Dante Wright was pulled over. It was because he had expired tag. That's something that his mom started. And she's the state's attorney for Baltimore, Maryland, and she doesn't even know what happened?
Yeah, remember, she's the state's attorney that successfully prosecuted all those police officers in the Freddie Gray case. Oh, wait a second. All of them were
that out of touch?
Acquitted to the extent they ever went to trial. Remember the Freddie Gray case? That was Marilyn Mosby. This is victimization all dressed up.
Promulgating lies.
I'm not responsible for my actions. These people who commit these crimes are not responsible for their actions. They just haven't gotten the help they need. Well, you want to start removing agency from people, which is what the left does. You want to be a purveyor of the soft bigotry of low expectations. It's not so soft. And that's what I don't care that he's black. He's a purveyor of that sort of thinking and that sort of bigotry. No, low expectations, no expectations. Forget expectations to achieve. there's not even the expectation to operate within the bounds of the law in civil society, even when you commit a violent act. That's not your fault. That's what public treating violence and crime control as a public health problem really means. That's what they're saying. And those are the policies they're pursuing. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan, I think we're missing part of the, there's an element of critical race theory in there, whereas...
Obviously. He just said, look at everything through a race equity lens. Yes, right.
Well, but the part is where you're going to feel uncomfortable if we're treating criminals differently, because what's worked systemically or what hasn't worked systemically has to be changed. That's the to me, that's the hidden message there.
It's not even, yeah, thanks for the call. It's not hidden, right? Race equity, systemic racism. He used that phrase in that same interview. Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. He's just giving you an academic version of the street version you get from Sharpton. John in Bridgeport.
Yeah, just real quick. You had Fulton Sheen playing yesterday. He did something called the selfish ego is what's going to run this country into the ground if we don't work with it. And as far as I'm concerned, these people that are committing these acts, there's no talking to them. And we need a government to protect us from them, and we're not going to get it. And it's becoming more and more clear, especially if I drive on the Dan Ryan Expressway, how selfish these people are. It's unbelievable. What do we do if the government's going to protect us? Now what?
Thanks, John. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Andy. It's amazing that the left in this country can still shock me almost every day now. But my main question is, does this policy strictly apply to African-Americans and Hispanics? Or does this carry across to white people as well? Because, you know, economically going back, if you look at, like, even in the early 1900s in this country, you look at the Irish and you look at the Polish and you look at the Italians, I mean, there was no work because of who they were. And, you know, their economic impact from generation to generation has been cycled. So now you have lower income and lower economic whites in this country because of those kinds of ways of thinking. So does that carry over into this policy for us as well, as a Polack myself?
Well, thanks for the call, Clay. You know, you'll have to examine that through the race equity lens, and then a determination will be made. So you'll have to cross your fingers on that. You know, it'd be nice if, in addition to talking about the family structure, and we've talked a lot about that, all the data, plus the lived experience, it's so overwhelming. But when you could just treat everything as a public health problem, you can paper over the fundamental problem, which is the destruction of the nuclear family. It's boring, I know. There's no easy fix. You can't write a check on somebody else's account and make it magically go away or get applause or get media coverage for talking about that, because that's going to take a long time to repair, if ever. But in the interim, for people who are adults and have platforms, you know, it might be interesting to understand the psyche of young men, generally speaking. And this is why we have, like, Dr. Leonard Sachs on from time to time, from boys to young men. Yeah, you know, and this can manifest itself in, you know, back in the day, growing up in a neighborhood that had a lot of outfit guys, and they were, you know, feared guys. They were respected guys to street gangs on the west side or the south side.
And kids were off limits back then.
Yeah, young boys want to be important. They want to be respected. They want to be perceived as strong. It doesn't necessarily mean they need to be the toughest guy, but they want to feel like they're an important person. And that's what street gangs or the outfit provides to some extent. So even if it's just mom or just dad or just grandma or just grandpa or just your teacher or your coach, you might remind kids, here's how you become that important man, that consequential man that you want to be. Here's how you live. I don't want to hear excuses. I don't want to hear my friends are doing this. I don't want to hear, but it's so difficult and it's unfair and this and somebody called me this name. I don't want to hear any of it. You want to be an important person. You want to be a consequential man. You want to live the life well lived. Then you do these things. You go to school. If you're at a terrible school, I'm sorry. You study outside of the assignments. You read these books. Here are the Western canons. Get to it. You operate within the bounds of the law. I don't care what your friends are doing. You do not commit a crime. You do not go to jail. You do not get start having children before you're married. You do those things, and you're going to find your way, and you're going to be an important man in this community, and you're going to live a consequential life. It's not that hard. It's hard because there's a lot of temptations, but it's not that hard, and it's a message that should be delivered all the time, and it rarely is. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Amy and Carroll Independent School District of Southlake in a suburb of Dallas, Southlake, Texas. It's the top achieving school district in the state of Texas. It has virtually no racial achievement gaps, which is almost unheard of. In part, that's because Southlake attracts high achieving families of all races. Well, a couple of years ago, this broke apart, and it's continuing to fragment. This breaking apart and push for critically race-theoried and theory-inspired policies was the result of a 2018 video in which the students, some of the students there, including white students, were singing along to rap songs that included the N-word.
Rap song doesn't have the N-word?
Well,
I mean, really, I always tell my players to make me a playlist, but I can't have the N-word or else you got to bleep it out. And then there's no playlist because it's impossible.
As Joy Pullman reminds us from 3 years ago now, media outlets went nuts on the story, Joy Pullman writing in The Federalist. Media outlets went nuts on the story, and so did local school board meetings, where sometimes crying taxpayers, parents, and students spent hours insisting their lives had been forever damaged by the kind of institutional racism in Southlake illustrated by the rap sing-alongs. They didn't complain about the songs. They didn't complain that the kids were listening to the songs. They just complained about things like teasing and graffiti and other such annoyances that came after the songs, because they had to buttress their case that institutional racism was all of the sudden afoot at Carroll Independent School District in Southlake, Texas. Among those parents who have gotten involved to push cultural competence plan, just another version of racial equity. I mean, it's just a manifestation of the racial equity, critical race theory inspired hustle. Russell Maryland, former Dallas Cowboy and University of Miami standout, and the widow of another former Dallas Cowboy, they, among others, are profiled in this piece on the topic recently filed by the ABC affiliate there.
Right now, we're in a fight for our lives. We're in a fight for our kids' lives.
Former Cowboy star Russell Maryland has lived in Southlake nearly 20 years, but for the past two, he's been part of a Carroll ISD committee crafting an equality plan for the district his three kids attended.
It is about the kids.
Lately, that Cultural Competence Action Plan, known as CCAP, has consumed every district meeting.
CCAP, at its core, is racist.
It's time to scrap the CCAP.
It started back in 2018.
Hey, we open the
A video of Carroll ISD students chanting a racial slur went viral, and then...
I can say no more!
Just months later, it happened again.
It was a terrible, terrible feeling.
Maryland says board member Matt Bryant begged him to join the committee, but has lately been unsupportive.
He had tears in his eyes and said, we need you to apply.
After strengthening the code of conduct, they created the CCAP, which establishes diversity and LGBT focus groups, a more inclusive curriculum, more awareness of the district's diversity, and a system to track and reduce discriminatory bullying.
But it's just a basic plan of human decency. No one's trying to trick anybody.
Angela Jones' son was called a racial slur twice in 6 months. She's also on the committee and says the plan has suddenly become political and clouded by misinformation.
But you can't even get to the conversation of what can we, tweak, because people have drawn lines in the sand.
Now it's stalled.
We need to pause and hold our government officials, our elected officials, accountable for what they're doing.
Kristen Garcia is suing the district, claiming board members broke the law by discussing the plan outside of meetings.
We need parents everywhere to understand that your eyes need to be open.
At a recent meeting, hundreds of students shared stories of discrimination.
My headscarf was pulled off my head one day. I was referred to as having a terrorist hat.
You have no idea what it's like to be called a...
But teachers knew about it the entire time.
Just ridiculous, hateful, crazy stuff. I said to myself, we got our own little local pandemic here. This is the pandemic.
But some parents say the cure is worse than the disease.
And I'm sorry if somebody spent 20 months of their life working on this, okay? Sometimes a stupid idea is a bad idea.
The purpose of CCAP is to impose a leftist worldview.
That's right. Yeah, so kids teasing, calling people names, particularly racially charged names, using racial epithets, that's wrong. And so the cure is to institutionalize the racialization of people. That's the whole point of this, right? We're trying to end counting by race by counting by race. This has been the great paradox of the left's position on race post-civil rights era to present. So, for example, in a 2019 retreat, Carroll administrators were given a preview of the school of the kind of instruction they'd be expected to oversee and carry out under a cultural competency regime. In slides presented at their retreat, teachers and administrators who chose to treat students, parents, and colleagues equally, regardless of their skin color or ethnicity, were accused of cultural blindness. If you treat people equally, the same, regardless of race or ethnicity, then you're culturally blind. Now you get to get culturally competent. You know what cultural competence means? White is bad, apologize. White is bad, perform these acts of contrition. That's how you're going to cure somebody using the N-word in the direction of somebody else in the student body? Does that make sense? Why is this important? It's Southlake, Texas. It's not happening here. It's the top achieving school district in the state of Texas. The state of Texas, the Republic of Texas. You think, I mean, how many times have I seen this? You think you're insulated? Your kids are insulated? If this can break apart the relative, it seems to me, community that existed at Southlake across racial lines, if it can break apart that easily there, you think any institution to which you or your children are affiliated is impenetrable?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Better start thinking about what you're going to say. At least there, you have some parents standing up at school board meetings and fighting back. Oh, and by the way, it's not just, you know, white versus black. It's a little bit more complicated than that, it turns out. And another parenthetical point, the widow of the Dallas Cowboy you heard in that piece, just in terms of the politics of it, Miss Cornish, Robin Cornish, who you heard along with Russell Maryland, promoting this. She told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in a February 2019 interview that the district was sweeping this, meaning racism, under the carpet, and they are complicit. Unfortunately, this is the way our country is right now. Southlake is a microcosm of that. We have someone running the country right now who says it's okay to be racist, referring to Trump. But it's not political.
No, not at all.
It's about the kids, right, Russell Maryland? Another parent, Juan Saldivar, the father of a South Lake student, said this: the idea that America is fundamentally flawed because some people have a racist problem in their minds, that's a recipe to keep you in poverty and unhappiness for the rest of your life. My parents always told me, it doesn't matter whether people like you, it matters whether the law protects you, and it does. Juan Saldivar. He said that most parents do oppose the district's rush into racial extremism over the past 3 years, but they don't want to talk to media outlets because their perspective is depicted as racist, even though their true goals are combating racism and ensuring equal treatment. But as we know, and also, by the way, having their kids and the students perform such that they prepare themselves for college and beyond. You know, they want academic excellence. That's probably why, in part, they moved to South Lake, sent their kids to Carroll, right? But those perspectives are squashed. Jimmy in Lombard.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing?
Hey, how you doing, Jimmy?
Oh, living the dream. Okay. I remember when I was a kid, they used to tell us sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Did we forget about that?
Yeah, right.
It was so simple. Remember those times?
Thanks, Jimmy. I didn't mean to cut you off, but yeah. And so, but what happens? By the way, there are two school. This is how it's going in South Lake at present. Two school board members have been indicted for violating the Open Meetings Act.
Of course they. Why wouldn't they have? Yes.
Because there's litigation flying back and forth. I mean, you know, these are successful people. Russell Maryland obviously had a successful NFL career. I'm sure he's doing well. I hope he's doing well. And you have, you know, I think in the Joy Pullman piece, they said the median household income in South Lake is four times the Texas average. So, I mean, these are well-to-do people that have resources and they're going to fight their fight, which is, frankly, better than we see in suburban Chicago. There's no opposition. Where are the Juan Saldivars in Chicago making sense? Absent without leave. Well, your school suffers as a result. And so you send your kid to schools that had reputations once upon a time as institutions of learning and preparedness, college prep schools that are no longer anything resembling a college prep school. Oh, and by the way, if you haven't noticed, and this is the problem at Loyola Academy, as far as I could tell, in Wilmette, since that's a story we've covered, and that somewhat approximates what's going on at South Lake, even though it's a public versus private situation. One of the problems at Loyola is that you lost your faculty. I got my hands on a letter from Loyola Academy's faculty to the administration from last year with all the cut and paste statements of that are critical race theory inspired as well, just like what you're hearing in this culturally responsive plan that's being advanced by, well, leftists or the race obsessed or some combination of the two, including the redundant ones in South Lake, Texas at Carroll. You lost your faculty. If you lose your faculty, then it's over. So this is why at Loyola Academy Wilmette, you've got parents pushing back and some parents just pulling their kids out. And you have sort of weak tea responses from the administration prompted by big donors making big statements that cause big hurt. So you get this, we appreciate the feedback and we always welcome that and we're working through these things and we remain committed to our mission of this and that and so forth. The problem they have is the faculty is gone. I'm sure there are exceptions. I'm making a general statement. And by the way, that general statement is based on the dozens and dozens of loyal faculty who signed this letter I'm referring to, which I have a copy of, so I'm happy to share if anybody wants to challenge the statement. And so the concern at a state school like Carroll in Dallas would be the same. You have people who are intimidated by the charge of racism, don't want to be made out to be the bad guy, and so they defer, to borrow from Shelby Steele, defer to the sentimental barbarians, to the race hustlers. Give away your school board, give away your faculty, and you give away your school, and you give away your community. That's how it goes. So keep that South Lake Carroll Independent School District of South Lake story in mind, and frankly, the Loyola Academy and Wilmette story in mind, too, when this ultimately comes to your doorstep, because if it hasn't, it will. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You know, Dan, I can't say sausage. I have to say sausage. It's really bad. I'm working on that. Coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer, we're going to talk about the Vax Pass in Chicago. And parents, if your kids are 16 or older, are you going to get them vaccinated? Mike, are you going to get yours? Because I know that you've got children in that age range.
I have one in that age range. And the decision has been made because of the experimental nature of the vaccine. We will not be.
Okay. Is that you're talking about your daughter, right? Yes.
I'm talking about one of my children.
Yeah, yeah. Because if I had a female teenager, it would be a lot different than if I had a male teenager. But
I think that's very true. Yeah, I think that's right. The science has informed us on that right now. So we'll take it as we go, and we'll see where it goes.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I wasn't going to get the vaccine, but that was until I found out I could get $5 off at Supercuts.
Wait, what?
Now I'm getting the Vax Pass.
You could also get a Krispy Kreme donut and a Sam Adams lager, by the way. But yeah, this Vax Pass is coming out in May, folks. We knew it wasn't if, but when this was going to happen. And Dr. Awardi explained yesterday, you know, just basically what it is, but not giving too much detail.
You'll hear more about Vax Pass, which is going to be some work where if you get a vaccine, you'll be able to get into a concert or get into an event, and really thinking particularly for younger people.
Yeah, the Vax Pass is going to be on your smartphone. It's, you know, a smartphone application that could be used by event organizers to require you that you've been fully vaccinated. And if you're not vaccinated, then maybe, you know, she said this isn't forced vaccinations, but if you want to have more fun, if you want to be part of the fun, she said, then get vaccinated. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I don't like the Vax Pass.
You know?
I don't like that name. I want something more regal sounding, like the Excelsior in New York. So if you have a better name for the Vax Pass, let's workshop some names there, too. Let's help the Rona Busters out with their marketing. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Also, a supporting question.
Yes.
Is that enough for you or for you to have your child get vaccinated that you can go see Foo Fighters at Wrigley Field?
Or you could go to a game because they, you know, they're following what the Dodgers did, and that's vaccination sections, you know, which, you know, they're still, they're not 6 feet apart. They're about 3 feet apart. Of course, you still have to wear your mask, blah, blah, blah. But that'll get you in to see a Cubs game or a Sox game. And that's, you know, I mean, they're dangling this over our head. This is the carrot to go and get vaccinated. And I respect you guys that aren't vaccinated. I respect those who are vaccinated. It's your choice. But as a parent, too, we've got the pressure of the school district. I've received two letters from CPS saying, here's, you know, go to this. If your kid is 16 and older, we strongly urge you to have your child vaccinated. Here's a place where you can go, log in here, blah, blah, blah.
Of course
they
do.
So I took my kids to the United Center, and I posted it on Twitter, and I said, as a parent, I decided to get both of my boys vaccinated. However, my decision was not a medical one, but a political one. I don't want them quarantined if exposed to a COVID kid, because you know that's going to happen. And I had a pit in my stomach. I want them to get their lives back. And it's true. I mean, I've never in my life, and I know a lot of parents are going through this, we're getting our kids vaccinated because for political reasons. Because if they're vaccinated, then when somebody in their pod or someone on their team gets, you know, is asymptomatic, then they won't have to sit out for 14 days. And I got destroyed on Twitter saying that, you know, I was brainwashed. It just went on and on about how You know, not that I'm a bad parent, but, you know, why are you being manipulated by the government? They want this, and that this isn't a vaccine. It's genetic therapy.
Well, right, the mRNA, the emergency use authorization only. I understand the arguments.
And I don't care. I mean, I like listening. People are like, oh, they're coming down on you hard. I don't care about that. I just wanted to hear people's opinions. You know, people say, why would you do that to your children? They're not in fear. They have a 99.998% chance of surviving. Well, my kids have had it, and they're fine. One didn't even know they had it, and the other one had a slight fever. So I don't know. I mean, the government's pushing for this because right now the supply outweighs the demand for it. And so they've got a problem on their hands, not only in Chicago, but also in Los Angeles and in New York.
They don't have a problem on their hands.
Well, that's okay.
Well, is that what they said? Well, they said it.
I can do it.
So we're just going to accept it at face value.
Dan, you could take your mask off outside when you're alone by yourself.
We don't have a problem because, as Dr. Roger Klein explained yesterday and we've said here, the pandemic is over. I know there are people that don't want it to be over because this has been the greatest time in their lives and they have shown such great leadership in their own minds. And they like peacocking around with their mask on, and they like moralizing to other people. And they've survived something really big. I mean, this is, for them, this was their Normandy. I get it. So they don't want it to end. They want to go right into film like Audie Murphy, you know, coming back from the war. They're heroes, you know, and they're waiting for... They don't want to give up the showering of praise within the little bubbles in which they reside. But I'm sorry, the pandemic is over, so no, they don't have a problem. We have a problem that we have ceded so much of our individual sovereignty to the state. That's a problem we have. And, you know, boy, that 10 bucks off my next salon visit or the ability to go watch the Cubs play, or in West Virginia, $100 savings bond for anyone 16 to 35 who gets vaccinated. I'm sorry, that's just not going to be enough for me.
Well, what about going to concerts and, I mean, going to the opera? Aren't you the Civic Opera House? Don't you want to step foot back in there?
We'll see. When's that going to open? 2025?
Well, when is it going to open? My gosh.
Larry and Carol Stream.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wonder if I take my vaccination card, is it valuable enough to get into a Cubs game for free? It's about what they're worth now.
All right. Thanks for the call, Larry. You might be able to get on the field with that. Cindy and Niles.
Hi. I'm wondering why no one is ever mentioning the thousands of us, perhaps millions, that have recovered from COVID. We have immunity. We don't need the vaccine. So our lives is stifled because of that?
I know. Natural immunity is not enough for some reason. But yeah, they know because the media doesn't do that. They instead they focus on the 0.01% of long haulers. You know, oh my gosh, long haulers. And someone needed a double lung transplant. Yes, that does happen, but it's not. They've magnified it to the point where they're scaring people again because that's what the media does. Fear sells.
Dirk and Stager.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Love you guys. Let's whip this thing into a real fear and call it what it is. It's the mark of the beast. The card.
The mark of the beast pass. All right. Thanks for the call, yes. Dirk. That's a pretty, it's not pithy enough, though. Excelsior. That's a name.
I like Vax Pass. You got your Vax Pass on you there, Toots. Can't you see that? Yeah. Also, too, real quick, the HHS secretary, by the way, was on CBS yesterday, and he said, the message is clear. You're vaccinated. Guess what? You get to return to a more normal lifestyle. If you're not vaccinated, you are still a danger, and you're still in danger as well. So get vaccinated. Hmm. That's where they were the buzzword yesterday. You're a danger. Dan, are you dangerous, Dan? Is that your new name?
Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Amy, I don't understand why you don't let your boys just make this decision for themselves.
Oh,
If they've already had it. Mm-hmm. Okay, but wait. If they've already had it, then why do they need to get a vaccine on top? The scientists on Fox News said that's a really bad idea, and you could cause autoimmune disease in your boys. So just because they could, you are capitulating. I don't understand why you're doing this. You have horrible reactions to it. and yet you're going to put your boys through that? They are not at risk.
I know they're not, but Candace, they cannot have a life unless they get vaccinated.
No.
Yes.
You sound so stupid.
Yes, it is stupid. And I've fallen in line and I hate myself for it, but I have to give them a better chance of life. That's why I got vaccinated. Yes, I do, because of the hell I live in, Candace. I can't just pick up my kids and leave like other people. I can't, because I have this thing called an ex-husband. Pardon?
You don't have to leave. That is ridiculous.
No, everyone.
That is ridiculous.
Well, because somebody in their pod's going to get it.
Everybody else is doing it, so let's do it.
No,
what's
I'm
the. What's wrong with you?
I don't know of any other parent that has gotten their kid vaccinated yet. But,
all right. That's the bell. Go to your
corners. You're nuts.
Thanks for the call, Candace. All right. Towel off.
Does that mean our lunch appointment's canceled?
Elliot on the south side.
Hi, I think this is a complete overstep of government. I think this is a complete lack of freedom personally. If we can't control what's injected into our bodies, what can we control? It's my body, my choice. And I think where there's liability, where there's profit, there must be liability. And where there's risk, there must be choice.
All right. Thanks for the call, Elliot. It's well said, succinct. Tom and Oswego.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I think my concern isn't this pandemic, because I think we already know that this is all a big joke, but it's what about the next one? And there will be another virus. Some, what are we going to do then? Are we going to just shut it all down again?
Well, it depends on how the government wants us to handle the next virus. The government, it may be beneficial to them. You know, or they may treat it like they did H1N1 when Obama was in. Nobody knew about H1N1.
Just think about it. Countries like Russia, China, they don't even need armies anymore. They could just create a virus and we will all panic and crawl into a hole. They don't even need to fire a shot. This is bad news. I tell you, it's not this one. It's the next one I worry about.
All right, Tom, thanks for the call. This one isn't over for them.
Right.
So I'm still worried about the implications of how long they can sustain this after the pandemic has ended, which it has in this country. George in Libertyville.
Yeah, hey, guys. You know, in these blue states, they're just going to see tens of millions of people completely pull out of the entertainment economic system. Major League Baseball with their crap, NBA long gone, now concerts. And you know, and we all know when is the real fat shaming going to start occurring? Because we know the most at risk are the heavy people, and yet you don't see anything related to that. Not that they should, but that's the insanity of this. So let them continue to crush the economy. Yes.
Thanks for the call, George. Yeah. Maybe it'll also advance the death with dignity movement, right? The so-called death with dignity. The 75 and out crowd, Zeke Emanuel and his friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, get rid of those pesky old people. They made us lock everything down. Are we above blaming people because they got to a certain age? I mean, look what we blame. Look how we scapegoat people as it is based on their skin color. We're above that. And obesity. Anybody with type 2 diabetes, maybe there should be a separate section of civil society for them everywhere, because they're more susceptible to respiratory viruses. I mean, let's apply the same logic to other cohorts of Americans. You want to do that?
That's what they're doing. That's why I feel you guys are being discriminated against. If you don't get vaccinated, you can't go have fun this summer.
Yeah.
What if you'll be able to go to the beach or Navy Pier, huh?
Yeah, gosh.
You want to go on that Ferris wheel. I know you're jonesing for
it. I can't. I don't. I need my Bubba Gumps, you know, a couple times a summer. That's going to be a real sacrifice.
Bubba Gumps.
John in Lincolnwood.
How about instead of X-Pass, let's call it compliance with the exclamation mark.
Oh,
yes.
Compliance pass. Yeah.
Thank you, John. Compliance pass.
Not great, but okay.
It's pretty good. Pretty good. Alan in Rockford.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good.
Last night on the news, the Winnebago Health
Department director came out and said, think of this as your social privilege. Oh. And it just, it landed on me like, what is this, like in China where you get your social score? I'm telling you guys right now, if somebody asks me for my vaccination card, which I don't intend on getting, I'm going to look them square in the face and say, I'm sorry, my dog ate it.
That's a good one.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Alan.
But also, too, Illinois, we're only at 30% vaccination rate, and we have to be to 70 to 80% for alleged herd immunity to get to this COVID bridge that Pritzker magically created with Dr. Nzike in La La Land. We got to get to the bridge and then over the bridge to phase five.
Mm-hmm. Robert in Bloomingdale.
Good morning. Yeah, I'll get one of these vaccinations once it's fully approved by the FDA, which is, you know, with where the science proves after the long term, which probably takes 2 years, that it's safe and it has no long term side effects. Because we find out, I'm sorry.
You need help with that tire?
There's bad side effects from this vaccine. Or what do I do then? Or what do young people do then? What do they do then? There's some kind of side effect for young women or something.
Yeah, they're looking into that. I mean,
they had to walk back in Dr. Walensky's comments about the virus, the vaccine rather, for pregnant women. CDC did.
Mm-hmm.
They had to walk that back in. She can't even keep track of what the CDC guidelines are. The CDC can't keep track of their own guidelines, but we're supposed to live and die by their edicts. I don't think so.
We got a text message. Children do not need protection from COVID. They need protection from government and health officials. That's a pretty good one.
Ken in Plainfield.
Yeah, my curiosity is, and I haven't really heard this addressed, is I can't get the shot because of a previous autoimmune disease. I can't even get a flu shot if I wanted either of them. I couldn't give two craps about going to a baseball game, but if I want to fly to see one of my kids, am I going to be the new modern-day leper? You know, you can't go because you can't get the shot.
Well, you'd have to... Well, or
we're going to set up colonies for people like you, Ken.
Well, you can have a negative test before you get on the plane. I mean, they're not mandating that now, but who knows?
No, but...
Yeah, but...
Yeah.
Because there are people like you who
can't
get
the shot. What's it coming to?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, what's it coming to down the road?
Thanks for the call, Ken. You know, when they get around to it, they'll have a special pass that you can get so that you can participate somewhat, maybe meaningfully, in society, you know, to the extent that they feel safe. Out of abundance of caution, they may not let you see your children anymore, travel to see your children anymore, at least by plane. But, you know, we'll see. You know, your life is a consideration down the road for your betters.
Isn't that crazy, too, about how many grandparents haven't seen their grandchildren in the past year and a half? Are you kidding me?
Mike on the north side.
Yes, please tell the government to keep their grubby hands off my body. Anyone that gets a vax pass goes on the bitch list. And you're banned from all LGBT events. And Dan, forget about movie pair. I'll serve you all the beer you want for $10 a crack.
But do you have a powerboat that can take me around the playpen like the sea dog?
Mike. I've got a little scooter you can take around the yard.
All right, very good. That's good enough. Thanks for the call, Mike. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Joe Biden walked out to address the throngs of D.C. media types, and he came out with a mask.
And he came back in with just his aviator glasses.
Then he took the mask off. It was something akin to Hamlet encountering Yorick's skull. It was so Shakespearean in its import, and he said this.
Starting today, if you're fully vaccinated and you're outdoors, you need, and not in a big crowd, you no longer need to wear a mask.
Thank you, Jesus.
I want to be absolutely clear. If you're in a crowd, like a stadium or at a conference or a concert, you still need to wear a mask. even if you're outside.
Mm. Thank you, Master, for setting me free. I was already not wearing a mask outside because I'm not an idiot.
And the other message that was sent,
yes,
was go get vaccinated, especially you youngsters.
For those who haven't gotten their vaccination yet, especially if you're younger or think you don't need it, this is another great reason to go get vaccinated now. Now.
Yeah. By
the
way,
convince you, Dan?
In Hamlet, you know his fascination with Yorick Skell. Hamlet's, you know what that represented. It represented Hamlet's ever-deepening existentialism in the wake of his father's death. And I think that what we're seeing is a deepening of Joe Biden's nihilism in the wake of the end of the pandemic, which is upon us. But that's just my Shakespearean interpretation, trying to metaphorize it with pandemic policy. Just, I don't know, to keep my interest, perhaps. Yeah. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Noah Rothman, our friend from Commentary Magazine. He is also the author of the book Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America, associate editor for Commentary, I should mention. Noah, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Science driving this decision, the science that we were fairly familiar with about 10, 11 months ago?
I mean, I kind of doubt it. Our COVID policies haven't really been dictated by the capital T, capital S science for quite some time. Over the weekend, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has generally advised against intuition, intuiting your way through these situations, using common sense, appealed, in fact, to common sense. Explicitly said, listen, you know, the science, we don't have a lot of data around this, but common sense suggests that you don't have to be vaccinated or you don't have to wear a mask if you're vaccinated and you're outside. And lo and behold, the president followed up 48 hours later after, you know, a deluge of elite opinion around this, New York Times, The Atlantic, Slate, all of them saying, listen, what's with these outdoor mask mandates? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then all of a sudden the clouds parted. And we're bestowed with permission to do what everybody's already been doing. The CDC guidelines that came out yesterday are functionally indistinct for people who are masked or unmasked. Just go to a restaurant. Everybody around that table is unmasked, of course, because they're eating. Do you really think they're all vaccinated? Do you think everybody at that table is related to each other? I mean, if you do, you're a very credulous person. This is sort of the precautionary paradox, right, which our colleague Jim Meggs writes about in the magazine. You're making this condition to pursue maximum safety is, in fact, making us less safe because it's creating a dissuasion. It's dissuading people from getting vaccinated because there are no incentives to do so.
Right.
Therefore, creating the conditions that will perpetuate the very conditions that they're trying to mitigate against. It doesn't make a lot of sense unless you're just really terrified of being proven wrong in the event that there's some sort of a resurgence, right? Which is possible, but a minimum risk. And in mitigating against that minimum risk, they're inviting a much more serious present threat.
And there's not much difference between, you know, if you're masked or vaccinated or not vaccinated. The rules are pretty much the same. If you're outdoors, you can bike, run, do whatever you want without a mask on. And that people were already doing that. I mean, this guidance echoes what Americans, you know, already do. But what's next? What's the next thing to roll back? Because this is, you know, these erroneous guidances that they had in place or in the first place, they're slowly rolling them back until what? We're unmasked indoors?
Well, I mean, possibly. And I think that should be the guidance that we should be getting. Vaccinated people should be allowed the freedom to be unmasked everywhere, with the exception of really crowded settings like people literally on top of you. Which is hard to envision, right? Because one of the contradictions in these guidelines is that, listen, if you're at a sporting stadium event, right, it's outside, but it's really crowded and packed, and you got to wear a mask. But most of these stadiums, with the exception of a few places like Texas, already circumscribe attendance to the tune of maximum allowed attendance is something like 20-30%, so they're not going to be crowded. Right. And nevertheless, this is the guidance that you have to adhere to in these not crowded settings, which
they call crowded, but they're not crowded because of mitigation efforts. It's enough to drive you crazy to the point where I think people are going to start tuning this sort of thing out. I mean, this sort of maximum absolutism is enough to make people who are already on the margins of listening to authority figures anyway just simply throw their hands up and say, listen, I'm going to navigate this as best I possibly can.
Yeah, I think that's where most people are at. I think that's where they're at already. I mean, other than the real devotees to the state and the COVID enthusiasts and the ill-informed and fear-addled. So that represents some fraction of the population. But there have been so many contradictory statements made by CDC, including St. Fauci, over the last year. The science upon which, as you, I think, accurately described the timeline, all of a sudden everybody wakes up one day and figures, hey, what's with these masks outside? This is kind of silly. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, writing in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, I mean, he's late to the dance, too, by the way, so I'm not holding him up as an example. But the studies he's citing about transmission outside are 6 and 8 months old. But we're so attuned to the science and data. No, we're not.
Yeah, and there's just a paucity of data around this sort of thing. So we really do have to rely on common sense, on individual intuition, and individual risk aversion. Because that's, first of all, that's something that you're already used to in your day-to-day life. You understand that when you go swimming, when you eat shellfish, when you take a bath, you're assuming a certain level of risk. You just understand that you can absorb that risk, and most likely you're going to get through it okay. That's at the stage that we're getting very close to when it comes to the prevalence of this virus for people who are vaccinated. If you're unvaccinated, it's a very different story. But we also have to accept the fact, and I don't think we have, that there's going to be a substantial portion of the adult population that will never be vaccinated.
Yep.
There's nothing you can do to reach them. They are recalcitrant. They have medical issues. They have religious objections. Whatever it is, there's going to be a portion of the population that will prevent us from reaching universal adult immunization. We have to accept that, because once we do, then we can begin to talk about an arbitrary threshold at which point we can declare the pandemic locally over. And if you need an off-ramp, the United Kingdom has that off-ramp. Right now in the UK, vaccination is around 30-40% of the population, but the herd immunity threshold appears to be kicking in because the rate of deaths and hospitalizations is so low, it's approximating what you get from a general flu outbreak or a pneumonia outbreak, which is normal, which we should accept as normal. And it would be an arbitrary way to say, look, the pandemic's over. It's not based on data. But it is an off-ramp, and it's one I think we're going to have to eventually take, because the alternative is to do this in perpetuity.
But Dr. Walensky said that yesterday. She was on with Lester Holt. She said hospitalizations are down. Death rates are low, lower than they were in the summer. So why we should be on that off-ramp?
Yeah, Dr. Walensky has a very bad habit of saying things she believes to be true.
Yeah.
She's unfortunately quite honest, and it's gotten her in a lot of trouble. She said things like, teachers don't have to be vaccinated, and then she's gotten... the universe has come down around her shoulders, and she's had to backtrack. She's talked about herd immunity thresholds that doesn't comport with what the Biden administration's political goals are, and she's had to backtrack. I don't think this is going to be any different. I think we're probably going to get something like a qualified backtracking of what we understand to be common sense. God bless her for speaking, out of turn, because she's saying things that people who follow this for a living know to be true, believe to be true. It's politically inconvenient to say as much.
But before we let you go, John Kerry denies that he told the Iranian foreign minister about Israeli attacks in Syria. What's your handle on John Kerry's exposure here, and what should be done to pursue this story?
It's interesting that you use the word exposure, because that's what it is. In the event that these were classified American national security secrets provided to us by our ally in Israel, it would be a criminal violation to divulge that to anyone, to the press, much less an adversary of the United States like the Iranian foreign minister. I have to believe that Javad Zarif wasn't making it up when he was apparently rather surprised by this information. Maybe he was feigning surprise, maybe not. But the bottom line is, it was extremely irresponsible, and there should be consequences for it. I doubt we'll see them, but there should be.
Noah Rothman, Associate Editor for Commentary Magazine, author of Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Thanks as always, Noah. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy are still trying to come up with a better name for VaxPass, also to make it more attractive. I know, I believe, did Alison Arwarty say you get a free membership to the hair club for men?
along okay.
With that? Is that?
Come on.
No.
That happens to a lot of people. Women too, not just men. Have
no, heard. I know. Yeah, so that's why the hair club for men exists,
right? That's sexist.
Mr. Sperling,
it should be the hair club for people, not the hair club for men.
For humans, yeah. I mean,
she could be a spokes. I've got an idea. I've got a marketing idea.
Sperling? Wasn't he not just the president, but he's also a member? Wasn't that?
Oh,
the,
that's right. Yeah, he is.
I think you maybe sweeten the pot a little bit with an autographed copy of the Rona Busters with each Vax Pass.
I mean, they think still that that was such a great idea that when you walk into City Hall, into the mayor's office, it's blown up to poster size on the wall, them dressed as Rona Busters. If I was her PR person, I would have fallen on a grenade before I would have let her walk in to talk to the press dressed like that.
John and Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
I figure if we take two words and put them together, you know, a three-letter word and pass and make a fancy word, call it aspis.
Aspis, sure. Thanks for the call, John. We have sort of like a Mark of the Beast reference that was offered by another caller. Yeah, still trying to zero in on like Lightfoot Laminate. There's something there, but we're not there yet. So.
No.
Keep spinning your propellers and give us a calls and texts with suggestions for the VaxPass rename that we're initiating today.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden to give his not State of the Union address tonight, in which he is going to call for universal preschool program for 3 to 4 year olds, 2 years of tuition free community college for all Americans, including Dreamers, and more money for child care and boost federal funding to child care providers, national paid leave program for those needing time to care for a child. And so on and so forth. $1.8 trillion worth. I mean, I remember when $1.8 trillion was a lot of money. Now it seems positively pedestrian.
Monopoly money.
But maybe on the tax side, it's a little bit more offensive to the likes of one Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, and Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys. And by the way, I tend to agree with Joe Biden on all this money for, you know, universal child care and universal pre-K. You know, the problem in America is we've got to get these kids out of the hands of these unprofessional parents, right? And we've got to get the kids, you know, in front of the government.
The experts.
Because they've done such a great job with our 6 to 18-year-olds. The problem is, you know, we're not getting a hold of them quickly enough. So if we can get a hold of these kids and out of the, you know, parents are just unprofessional. So we give them, you know, the 3 and 4 and 5 year olds to the government and everything will turn out just fine.
Well, I mean, Steve, if you wait until they're 5 and 6, they may have already decided that they're a boy or a girl. And that's a decision for the school to make in conjunction with the child.
No, I mean, it really is. This is the way liberals think. I mean, they really believe that. You know, somehow, you know, the problem is that the parents just aren't doing a good enough job. And therefore, you know, we've got to get these professional bureaucrats to do it. And again, folks, these are the people who are educating our 6 to 18 year olds. And if you like the job they're doing, you know, in the public schools with the 16 to 18 year olds, you're going to love universal. And by the way, all of these people, the child care people, the pre-kindergarten people, they'll all be union. You know, they'll all be part of the teachers unions.
And in addition to the 2 years of free community college, number one, one of the attractions of community college is you can, you know, go get your gen eds knocked out at a relatively low tuition cost. You can also, you know, it's work. It's open enrollment. So, I mean, community college is really a barrier to entry to post-secondary education? I don't think so. It's actually a nice intermediate step for a lot of people, and that's and as well as people that are older coming back to get schooling or training or whatever. So, I mean, community college isn't where the tuition inflation problem is. It's in the colleges and universities in this country. It's interesting that Joe Biden didn't want to go there.
Well, a couple points about this. First of all, I'm a big, big fan of community colleges and technical schools. You know, the idea that every 18 and 19-year-old he has to go to, you know, some kind of liberal arts school where they're not being taught much anyway is a waste of money, I think. Actually, I think the biggest financial scam in America is these, you know, elite colleges and universities. But I also, you know, my own personal experience, having gone to the University of Illinois, is that I found, and I don't know if this has changed, but there were a lot of kids who were working while they were in school. And the kids who were actually paying their own tuition by working, they were much better students. They took college much more seriously. They were actually learning things because they were paying for itself. And my point is, this idea that everything has to be given away for free, I hate that ethic. I mean, look, are we saying 19 and 20 and 21 and 22-year-olds can't possibly work, you know, while they're going to school? Why do they have to be full-time students? We should have kids working and going to school at the same time. And this idea, you know, look, half of the kids at University of Illinois were just, you know, hanging out at the fraternities and sororities and partying and stuff like that. And we're paying, you know, all this money for those kids.
Well, I mean, I'm in complete agreement. I wanted to get to, on the tax side, what is being bandied about and maybe what will be at least referenced generally tonight, and specifically on the capital gains tax, because Scott Sumner over from the Mercatus Center, George Mason, had a good write-up at his blog on this, just how terrible the news coverage is, how ignorant the press corps is, even though this is hardly a new topic. This gets batted around every administration in one direction or the other, and people reporting this, including for like Bloomberg, have no idea what they're talking about when it comes to capital gains. For example, this from Bloomberg. A group of economists recently argued in the Chicago Booth Review that the prevailing wisdom among scorekeepers that the revenue maximizing rate is about 30%, that the revenue maximizing rate is about 30% may be misplaced and could allow for an even higher rate. A pair of Princeton economists published research in December showing hikes may raise substantially more tax revenue than scorekeepers currently believe, and the revenue maximizing rate for capital gains, long-term capital gains, may be about 40%, almost exactly where Biden's proposal falls. How convenient. They've also made the case that cuts in capital gains rates have a negligible impact on investment decisions and economic growth. That's in Bloomberg. And Sumner's one-sentence response to this, well, wait a second. If capital gains taxes have no impact on behavior, then why isn't the revenue maximizing rate 100%?
It's just awful
coverage.
Yeah, and look, it's very simple, folks. I mean, even the term capital gains tax is kind of, you know, hard for people to understand. A capital gains tax on a share of stock, right? And so when you sell your stock and you have a gain on the stock, you pay a tax on it. By the way, not just a stock, but a business. So let me give you a good example, I think, a real-life example of why the capital gains tax is so negative for investment and growth. And that is, you know, my son just recently, he has lived in Silicon Valley for the last 5 or 6 years. He recently started a business, a technology company, which, when someone starts a small business like that, especially in the technology industry, you need, you know, several million dollars of capital to get the business off the ground. And what does someone who's 28, 29, 30 years old do to get money to start a business? Well, typically what happens is you go, the first round of capital investing, it comes from the round is called friends and family. So I wrote a pretty big check to my son, you know, because I believe in him. I think he's going to make it. But look, 2 out of 3 small businesses fail, right? So there's a good chance I'm going to lose everything that I gave him for this, invested in it. But I think, you know, I'm hoping and I have confidence in him. But my point is, if you tell, you know, so there's a good chance I may lose everything I put in, but I'm putting the money in because I think, hey, you know, if this thing works out, I could really make a lot of money on this. But now the government's going to say, by the way, Steve Moore, if that business does, you know, take off, the government's going to take half of the profits away from you. Well, guess what? I mean, this is just human nature. My my decision to invest in a business like that is going to be reduced, right? I mean, if the government's going to take all the winnings away from me, then why would I invest in the company in the first place? So my point is, I think we're missing an important argument here. If we want great new small businesses started in this country, that you've got to have a tax that is lenient and low on the people who actually invest in those businesses. I'm not talking about the Googles and the Apples and so on. I mean, they actually started with friend and family rounds too. And look, now they employ, you know, millions of people. So this is anti-business. And by the way, I believe, and I've looked at the evidence over the last, 40, 50 years going back to the 1970s, I believe the revenue maximizing rate for capital gains is closer to about 20%, not 28%. But the Joint Tax Committee, by the way, people don't know what that committee is, but they're the people who do the official scoring of how much money will be raised or lost from a tax change. And they are the farthest thing from supply-siders. And even the Joint Tax Committee says the revenue maximizing rate is 28%. And Biden wants to take the 43%, which means, folks, we will lose money. We will lose money. We'll lose jobs. We'll lose investment. It's a lose to go to 43%. And one final point. You really got my blood boiling here. The capital gains tax is a double tax, right? Because there's also a corporate tax. In other words, we pay a 21% corporate rate before those profits are ever distributed to the person who owns the stock. So it's, you hit it at the corporate level, and then you tax the individual investor. It's really bad policy, and it's going to hurt the country a lot.
Well, I mean, someone's going to stop them, right? I mean, 43% for a capital gains tax?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. Amy, it's a great point. So I think Biden will try to get that rate up to 28%. And I think what they're trying to do is just come out with an outrageously crazy number of 43%, which virtually any sane person, except, I guess, man, these two Princeton economists you're talking about,
everyone agrees
that this is crazy. And I think what they're doing is saying, well, we'll just start with 43% and then we'll take 28%. But I think we should have, here's my policy, a 15% corporate tax that everybody pays, get rid of all the loopholes, and a 15% capital gains tax. If you want to maximize jobs in this country and maximize American competitiveness, let's go to 15% on capital gains, 15% on corporations. And one other point, Dan and Amy, guess what country would have the highest capital gains tax in the world if Biden has his way?
United States.
Yep. That's putting America last, not putting America first.
It's those two Princeton economists and about 48 of the 50 Democrat socialist senators that believe that 43% is reasonable. So I hope you're right, but I would be cautiously optimistic. I wanted to end on a policy happy note here, celebrate the examples of success. And one of the examples of success is the DeSantis administration in Florida. Florida announcing that the scholarship program it has, the school scholarship program it has, is expanding again. It's increasing the eligible household income cap from 300% to 375% of poverty level, which gets to a family of four of about $100,000, although it prioritizes households that are much below that household income level. And they also escalated the enrollment cap by 1% of public school enrollment annually, allowing 28,000 new students to enroll each year. I mean, there's somebody who, and it obviously preceded DeSantis, goes all the way back to Jeb Bush. But for the last 20 years, Florida has methodically been pursuing school choice to the benefit of its families, disproportionately minority families in Florida, and still a state without an income tax, one of the lowest tax states in the country.
I mean, DeSantis is a star. I know I say this every week. I was in Florida again this past weekend. I mean, if you want to see freedom, you have to go to Florida, right? And, everything is totally back to normal there. The stores are open. The restaurants are open. The schools are open. Everything's open. And, DeSantis has been the best governor in America. Very, it might be, if he's not the best, he's in the top three. And what a contrast. Your idiot governor in Illinois.
Oh, I mean, Pritzker
is probably one of the worst governors. And it pains me to say this because I do love the state of Illinois. I love Chicago. But my goodness, why is it that Illinois cannot be fully opened up right now? We've got 80% of our seniors are now vaccinated. Virtually everywhere. I don't know if this is true in Illinois, but where I live, it's true. if you want a vaccination, you can now walk in and get it. You don't have to have an appointment.
Same with us.
My wife got her flu shot yesterday, 15 minutes. So, look, folks, we don't need to lock down anything anymore. Everything should be opened up. How about Biden? You know, he has this thing about, well, you don't have to wear a mask outside. Then he wears a mask while he's outside.
Well, that was political theater. He wore it out, and then it was the moment where he took it off and, you know, the clouds parted. And then he walked back in without his mask on. See the significance there? Yes.
Well, we should never have had outdoor masks in the first place. But I want to mention one quick thing since I know we're running out of time. Have you seen, I've got a big story now that we're just releasing in our hotline today. There is something very, very, very fishy about the new Census Bureau numbers about population changes. They revised upward, the Biden census revised upward the population of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Illinois, California. All of the, virtually all the blue states had upward revisions of the massive, by the way, I think it was a couple hundred thousand upward revision in Illinois, 850,000 upward revision in New York, 850,000 people all of a sudden, you know, we didn't know they were there and they're there. And meanwhile, virtually all of the red states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, North Carolina, South Carolina had downward revisions. My question for you is, do you think that's a coincidence?
I think it, the same people that were in charge of the election in November were apparently in charge of the census.
I shouldn't be laughing. I mean, I think there's something really suspicious here, you know, and now they're politicizing the census. I mean, look, I don't have the evidence, but, you know, it is certainly circumstantial. When you look at those states that gain population, massive increases in the blue states. And by the way, how did New York get 850,000 more people? Everybody's left New York during the pandemic.
Yeah, it's that's suspicious.
Activity. Right. Now, that's a good story to follow, too, because among other reasons, if Illinois could lose one more congressional seat, then we only be 16 to go until we have zero impact on the Electoral College, which is where I want us to get to.
Exactly. Well, look into that, guys, because it's a big story. I think it's going to get a lot of attention. They politicized the voting. They want to get rid of the filibuster. They want to sack the Supreme Court. And now, you know, the Census Bureau. When does this madness end?
All right. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, economist, Trumponomics author. Thanks, Steve.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And so we had this debate last week. It was fun. The debate in parenting advice and counsel, how you should raise children, what you can glean from other experiences in terms of informing how you raise children. On the one hand, we had Micheline Duclef, who is the author of the book Hunt, Gather, Parent. And she and her daughter actually went on this journey. Mayan village, Inuit village, a Tanzanian savanna.
Oh, that's right.
Right? And and observed and discussed parenting philosophy with people from different cultures.
Yes, and I was jealous.
versus David Ann Wilson, the authors of No Perfect Parents, Ditch Expectations, Embrace Reality. And their one thing, they each book has a sort of like one thing that is a real difference maker. And so it's sort of on a continuum, in which way do you trend? The hunt-gather parent, it was be accommodating to some extent. The takeaway was the one thing the three cultures had in common, don't yell at children. The ditch expectations, embrace reality model is you're going to make mistakes. You're going to fail as the Ann Wilson described this one story. You're going to put your foot through a wall once in a while.
Right.
And you just have to apologize, own it, say you were wrong. And that's the way to you know, address mistakes that you make parenting and I don't know, raise well-adjusted kids, which is, I guess, what everybody wants to do. All right. So let's get into it a little bit more deeply than we did, because we're fortunate enough to have the author of Hunt, Gather, Parent what ancient cultures can teach us about the lost art of raising happy, helpful little humans. Micheline Duclef is the global health correspondent for NPR Science Desk and author of this bestseller, the title of which I just gave you. Micheline, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So it's interesting that you took your daughter along in this journey to explore how parenting operates in these different cultures. And I wonder what her reviews were of your parenting after reviewing the parenting style of the other cultures.
So, daughter, how am I doing?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think she likes me a lot better.
Oh, okay.
Now, definitely, definitely. I, you know, I think it's, you know, in your introduction, it's really interesting because I started off being a super angry parent, not really realizing it, but just, you know, just really kind of turning to anger a lot with her. And I have to say, like, I still, like, the other day I punched the wall. not in front of her, but, like, you know, I still get angry, but I've learned to, like, make it really quick.
Micheline, what would the Mayans say about that?
Yes, exactly.
They would not approve. They would not approve, for sure, for sure. I think it's not about being perfect, for sure, but learning some other tools as well.
Well, was she appreciative after seeing, you know, the Mayan way of life? Does she appreciate her way of life and what you've given her and provided for her?
Yeah, you know, definitely, like, seeing, you know, what other people have and don't have and the struggles they have or don't have, I think it definitely made her appreciate what we have and appreciate other people, you know. She actually, I think, enjoyed writing the book the most. She had a blast, and I mean, most of the places we went to, there were, like, a bunch of kids there that basically took care of her, you know, like, took her under their wing, and she really loved every minute of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great experience for her to experience those cultures and that sort of long, intimate form. That's very cool. And also to see that, you know, it's great to have what we have, but there are kids that and families that live in different cultures that make different choices and that can also be very happy being in a, I don't know, in a whaling village, an Inuit whaling village or something, too. It's sort of the Western definition isn't everybody's definition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I really saw really appreciated was many of these families have a very calm, peaceful existence with each other. There's very little conflict. You know, I grew up in a home where there was a lot of conflict, and that was how I was raising my daughter Rosie before. But I saw a different way where there can be a lot of peaceful coexistence and, you know, less, no negotiating, no bickering, and no yelling and arguing. And that's a wonderful, wonderful way to live.
Now, what about you? Because when we talked about this with our listeners the other day, we got a little pushback on the, you know, I make a request, go make your bed, and then I turn and walk away. And if the child doesn't make the bed, then you just sort of wait them out, I guess is sort of what I took away from at least what was done in that Mayan village. And you know, at some point there needs to be carrot and stick. There needs to be serenity and accountability. And you know, I guess it's a balancing act. So I just wonder how you react to that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think sometimes parents will walk away, but a lot of times the parents will say something to tease or kind of shame the child to make it clear that the behavior, what they're doing, you know, they're not forcing or yelling, but they're also not just like not doing anything and throwing their hands up. So, you know, they can say some pretty kind of harsh things like, you know, oh, you didn't make your bed because you're a baby, you know, or they can be really sarcastic, like, oh, you be so helpful, you know, you're just so helpful, you know, so there can be like,
oh, okay.
That would be Dan's approach.
No.
That sounds like something Dan would say.
Well, yeah, so this is so important because, I mean, that's seems to me the key. The name calling can continue. It just needs to be done at room temperature. Oh, great.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Fine.
Like less emotion, right? In both directions,
right.
Too. Praise, too, right? Oh, that was helpful. Versus like, oh, my God, you're such an amazing kid. That
yeah,
kind of
right.
Thing, right?
Yeah,
like
right.
This statement. Yeah.
Well, so how what was it like going from a Mayan village, and how long did you spend in the Mayan village, and then you went to a village north of the Arctic Circle? Those are pretty drastic extremes in weather.
We spent about 2 weeks in each place. And, yeah, that's what's so amazing is that, like, we went from the Yucatan where it was, like, literally 100 degrees and it was they were in a heat wave. And then we went up to the Arctic. In the summer, it's, like, 50s, 60s. But, you know, such different environments, and you can still see these tools, these parenting tools. So that teasing is, like, there in both places. And then we went over to Tanzania, and again, you see similar tools. So...
Can you also say, just again, very calmly, like conversational level, can you say, I brought you into this world and I can take you out? Are you allowed to say those things too, if you say them very at a conversational level?
Yeah, like absolutely. You know, there's so many funny things and like really like pointed things that like, you know, some of the moms will say things like, you know, very clearly, like, if you know, oh, you don't want to clean up your toys, okay, then I'm just gonna, you know, we'll throw them away. And they'll like go and start to, yeah, like, you know, I mean, you know, it's like if you can't take care of them, we're throwing them away, you know.
What was your favorite place?
So there's not, that's not that different than a lot of, I think, families here. Then it's not as different as at face value in terms of if you're allowed to be sarcastic, make subtle threats, name call, then I think we're more or less on the same page.
I think we are. And, you know, I think there's parts of the U.S. where this has kind of gone out of fashion, right? You're not supposed to tease kids. You're not supposed to make them feel bad. But that, like you said, I mean, I think that this is common now, but I think it was really common, you know, 50, 60 years ago. Now, right. For sure.
Did anybody yell at their kids? Or do you think that maybe they were behaving because you were in front of them, but normally they would scream at their kids?
So definitely not in the Maya village, in the Inuit village. People just don't yell. In fact, when we were living with the Inuit village, I never heard one person yell at another person. Like the entire time I was there. Like it's just really taboo. And they're taught just very early on to be very even keel, like, you know, and meet every problem just very even. In Tanzania, the people, the Hatabi are like more emotional, a little more, a louder culture. And so I did see one young mom yell at a child, but it was very, very uncommon.
Yeah, but, you know, you just wonder for families where, you know, like my grandfather yelled at my dad, he yelled at me. We want to keep this tradition going. You know, this is part of our heritage, yelling at
people. It's exactly right. That's what you, I mean, and the moms and dads told me that. Like, you yell at your kids, that teaches them to yell, right? And so that's why they, I mean, it's hard. But my little girl, just every time I yelled at her, we just got in these horrible fights, even as like a 2-3-year-old. It just didn't work. So I just stopped. I stopped. I still get angry, but I really don't want to yell. I try. I really try hard.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that is good. It is really interesting, but I prefer sort of the scalpel rather than the meat axe, right? Just the passive aggressive cuts, the sarcasm. It's so much more effective, I think.
I think so too. And you know, if there's less emotion and it's a little bit more factual too, I think kids take it as guidance more. Like that's another thing I saw when we were in all the places, is that the kids could take criticism. You know, they could take these like notes or, you know, comments, and they didn't, you know, go and cry. They were like, all right, well, I need to do something better. And I think it makes the kids stronger, you know.
Not
coddling them.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, all cliches are true. I mean, kids crave discipline. Kids crave crave boundaries, right? They're always testing their boundaries.
Yeah, I think we underestimate what they can take, and they can take a lot more when it's not done in anger or, you know, with a very, like you say, a meat axe, when it's done just, you know, more even keeled. Like, it's a fact. You don't make the bed, you're not being helpful. Fact, right?
How much does expectations, cultural expectations, play into the parenting styles? You think one of the things that was said by a caller, too, is, you know, that perhaps our expectations are a little bit different about what the kids are going to go on to do, or, you know, the demands of keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak. Perhaps they're more tight-knit and less competitive, more collaborative as a community, those sort of cultural differences that matter.
Yeah, I definitely think. I think in the U.S., kids are taught, you know, to figure out what you want and go and achieve it, really, at all costs. And I think there's a lot of that there, like, go, you know, families want kids to succeed, but they also expect the children to help each other, right, to help the family, to be a member of a team, and to constantly be looking out for each other, whether that means helping with the dishes or helping with your little sibling. There's from day one, there is an expectation that everybody helps and everyone shares and everyone is kind to each other in the family. And so there's that added on top of kind of achieving your own goals. You need to be a good family member as well, which I really think is important, you know?
She is Micheline Duclef. She is the global health correspondent for NPR Science Desk, the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, What Ancient Cultures Can Teach Us About the Lost Art of Raising Happy, Helpful Little Humans. Micheline, thanks so much for joining us. The book is great, and we appreciate you being with us and continued success with it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this anonymous posting at Outline, why I'll keep running with my mask.
Oh, please. Okay.
Yeah. Here's somebody.
I can't wait.
You know why it's anonymous, because people would want to beat this person if they knew who he was.
A mask enthusiast. Okay, I can't wait to hear the story.
I'm not going to lose my running mask just yet. Not because I'm addicted to the pandemic or distrust science or the advice of CDC. Au contraire, I'll be the first to explain all the ways we know running outside with a mask is safe.
Same.
But I first started wearing my mask outdoors as a courtesy.
Oh, should we start
the
music?
A signal to my neighbors that I cared about their health and was taking precautions to keep them protected. As we begin rolling back pandemic restrictions, resuming normal life, in quotation marks, I'm not quite ready yet to stop sending that message.
Neighbor, I love you.
Mm-hmm. While I believe we don't need to wear masks outside, I'm also sympathetic to the trauma we've endured as a nation, as a city, as individuals. It's hard to flip from the mindset of wear a mask constantly or risk killing your grocery store clerk, or don't bother wearing a mask outside at all. Don't bother wearing a mask outside at all.
Stop it.
Particularly when you live in a former COVID hotspot like I do. Those habits are especially hard to let go of. Masks represent a semblance of control and comfort that we've wrestled back from the disease, a way to navigate public spaces again without fear of strangers that had tainted every interaction early in the pandemic. Oh. That's why. I'll keep running with my mask. Finn. By the way, was that music bad? Was that Hoosiers?
No, I think that was the Notebook.
Oh, it was Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump.
Okay. It sounded, I was reading, so I didn't quite.
I know, but it sounded great. I mean, it was really inspirational. You really felt like you were there with him, with his need to wear his diaper on his face while he's outdoors running by himself.
Because he was running with his mask.
I'm sorry.
Now I'm hungry for bubblegum shrimp.
No. But you can't go unless you're vaccinated, Dan. Don't even look at Navy Pier. I don't want to even look at it, okay?
What about trinkets for my relatives who live outside of the city? I Heart Chicago trinkets. I can't pick any of those up.
Nope. Can't step foot. And don't even think about getting on that Ferris wheel or the Sea Dog.
How about Vax Populi? Vax Populi. That's the vaccine pass. Vax Pass.
The app on your phone.
Right. Still working on it. That's not a winner. But
Vax Pass isn't doing it for Dan, that's for sure.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The results of the annual Seattle Public Safety Survey. Going to perhaps be a bit surprising to you, considering Seattle was home to the Autonomous Zone during the Jenny Durkin-inspired Summer of Love, you may remember.
Oh, yes, and people died and got shot, and police couldn't come in to help.
According to the Seattle Public Safety Survey, which was conducted by researchers at Seattle University, the confidence in police barely changed in 2020. Where Seattle's supposed to be the tip of the spear, along with Portland, for defund the police, reimagine the police. But not according to residents. According to media and politicians, that, you know, which they have this symbiotic relationship, don't they? Because one serves the other and then right back at you. So they become their own little echo chamber. But if you actually get residents' views, when they were asked last fall to select their top public safety priorities, the most popular categories were police capacity, property crime, and homelessness. By police capacity, respondents mean there are not enough officers in their neighborhoods, and law enforcement responses are not fast enough. According to the study's principal author, Jacqueline Helfgott, who's a professor at CLU, people are saying they want more, not fewer police. Well, wait, how's that? You're supposed to be defunding the police, reimagining the police, not just saying more of the same. What? Also this. So telling. Respondents were asked to rate their perceptions of various public safety institutions on a scale from 0 to 100. Among them were a series of questions related to trust and confidence in the police, which were combined into a category labeled police legitimacy. Professor Helfgott's analysis shows that white respondents rated police legitimacy lower on average than any other racial group. They were at 57.5%, or 57.5 on a scale of 100. Black respondents were at 61 out of 100. I keep going back to this because it is the best example ever. Tom Wolfe's Radical Chic, Black Panther fundraiser at Leonard Bernstein's Manhattan penthouse. Leonard Bernstein says to the Black Panther, "Aren't you offended by all of this opulence you see around you?" And the Black Panther says, "No, not really." And Leonard Bernstein, who owns the place, said, "Well, I am." This is it. White people, "I'm offended. Aren't you offended? Don't you want to defund police?" "No." "Well, I do on behalf of you." "Well, you're not on behalf of me," is what a lot of Black Americans are saying in big city America. Isn't that interesting? But the media and the politicians, the champagne socialists in the media and the politicians they serve, who then give it right back. This is so media generated, and you know, that symbiotic relationship I'm describing between big government and big media. Fascinating. And fascinating how few residents are actually buying it. Now, of course, they're going to have to change their voting habits at some point to correspond to what they're saying about these institutions like police. But at least there's some silver lining to be had, even in Seattle. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Pomper, who's an author, freelance writer, and retired Seattle police officer. He's got a new book, The Obama Gang, How Barack Obama, through his post-presidency foundation, assembled, launched, and wages the new assault on American law enforcement. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And before we start, I just want to let you know I was inspired by that letter you read in the last segment. So I have my Thin Blue Line mask on right now.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Right. Why I will continue talking on the radio and wearing a mask. It's for you.
Exactly. It's my next book.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very good. Thank
Chapter
you so
one
much.
Dedicated to Dampra.
Yes. Yeah. Such a public service. Well, just starting out in Seattle, since that's where you were a police officer, does that surprise you, the disconnect between the politicians that these same people elected and then their attitudes about police?
It doesn't. You know, I've thought about this a lot, and I think part of it is that, for instance, there's, you know, not a lot of conservatives, comparatively speaking, in Seattle, but I know the ones that are there, a lot of them, they just don't vote anymore. They know their vote doesn't count, and so they don't even vote. On the other side, of course, they're radicals, and they're going to vote far left every time. Then you've got the folks in the middle that I think the media has done a great job of scaring, you know, them about conservatives. And so they anybody that's got an R, forget it. And if somebody's even moderate, they're very suspicious of them. So it's like this weird schizophrenia where they understand the problems, they see the problems, they want the problems to change, but they don't vote to change them. In fact, I don't know if you've heard of Chris Rufo, He ran for city council here a couple of years ago, and they basically chased him out of the race by threatening his wife and his kid. You know, so and Chris is a great guy. He doesn't come off as a far, you know, right zealot or anything. And yet they, even somebody like him wasn't able to even get a foothold.
Well, right. I mean, it's amazing. But the schizophrenia, political schizophrenia you describe is very real, and it's in big city America all over the place. I don't know what breaks it either. Let's talk a little bit about your book, The Obama Gang. Barack Obama, through his foundation, is waging the latest assault on law enforcement. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the show, per the mayor of Baltimore and his dissertation on violent crime as a public health problem. And that's just why we need to reimagine policing, because we need to strip them of the warrior mentality, and they need to be peacekeepers and, public work in concert with public health professionals to treat violent criminals as victims of some affliction. Explain to us, because and I use him as an example because we hear this all the time from big city mayors, and I wonder if this feeds back into what you're talking about with Obama Foundation funding.
Yeah, that's part of it, because it's this false narrative between the police officer as a warrior and the police officer as a guardian, and I just don't see them as being mutually exclusive. You know, you want a guardian of society, a guardian of liberty. That's what I think the police officers are. And I think the warrior portion of what they do is their preparations to be able to carry out that mission. You know, so you've got somebody who trains the way they're supposed to train, and able to handle the situations that, you know, we all hope we don't get into. I think about the person who calls 911. Yeah, they want guardians, but they want a warrior landing on their porch when somebody's trying to break into their house. So they try to set that up. I mean, they've got it in, I think it's Jacob Pry in Minneapolis. He outlawed, quote unquote, what he called warrior training, which is basically police survival training in his city based on that false narrative. And that's part of what we're looking at in the Obama Gang book that the National Police Association wants to write, because that's what Obama and his organization is part of, what they're leading. And as far as dismantling the police is by setting up those false narratives that confuse people. You know, like I said, it's not mutually exclusive between warriors and guardians.
Well, and then also the Obama Foundation states on their website the Reimagining Policing Pledge. What exactly is that?
Yeah, that's my brother's Keeper Alliance pledge. And my brother's Keeper organization, that's fine. You know, they do some good things with schools and, you know, with keeping kids off the streets and that kind of thing. But when it comes to law enforcement, what they do is they've gotten 300 mayors at least, it's probably more by now, and 10 from the biggest cities in America. And what they do is they promise to review use of force policies in police departments, engage the public, and I love this one, that's just going out into the public and getting anecdotes about the police, so you can imagine what they're collecting.
Right.
They're supposed to report their findings back in about 3 months or so. And then I love the fourth one, reform the police. It doesn't say if you find some problems or, you know, with policing, then we're going to go ahead and initiate some reforms. It's just reform the police. And the thing that's missing, the element that's missing out of this whole thing is there's nothing about talking to the police. So you can see how that goes. But that's what that pledge is. It's almost like, the reason you call it the Obama Gang, kind of a nod to, kind of a mafia-styled situation. It's kind of their omerta, their oath, loyalty oath.
Right. And ultimately this is going into the place where we're decriminalizing crime. So, you know, we're moving from drugs to prostitution to, low-level, nonviolent burglaries or thefts. I mean, I'm sort of saying that with air quotes around it because that's the way it's been described by these non-prosecution prosecutors in places like Cook County. And
right.
So speak to that as well in terms of, it was the broken windows theory a fallacy. Do these low-level crimes, drug crimes, prostitution, retail theft, do they matter, or are prosecutors and police right to ignore them and focus on violent criminals, from a public health gestalt kind of way?
Right. Yeah, I've actually called it that, several times, of the decriminalizing of crime. And But these folks, they don't want to go to the legislature and then, you know, and get rid of the crimes. I mean, they do want to do that. But what they'll do is instead they'll just go ahead and start ignoring the crimes. And, you know, it really gets me that they ignore certain crimes against certain criminals is the way they do it. And, you know, so for instance, if you're in Seattle and you're a homeless person and you commit some kind of what they consider a low-level crime, you're basically untouchable. And yet if you drive through Seattle and you get stopped for speeding or running a stoplight, you're going to get that ticket and you're going to have to pay it. You know, so I'm thinking about, I don't know why people, you know, even want to pay those types of citations now when people are getting away with much more serious crimes than, you know, going through a stop sign or something like that.
Well, right.
So we're seeing yeah, that a lot.
And so one of the other things just to layer in here is police as revenue agents. So, yes, we'll continue to do the stops, although we've got red light cameras and we've got speed cameras and we've got all that. But we'll continue to do stops because that's revenue for the government, for the agency, and potentially for the police by extension. But, you know, like in Chicago now, you don't give chase in your car. And now, after this shooting of a teenager, now you have the mayor talking about don't give chase on foot.
Yeah, we started that in Seattle. We were way ahead of the you know, game on that way back, probably the early 2000s, I want to say. I remember an incident with a guy who I was in the academy with. He was ready to chase a car for whatever it was. And the bad guy, for better lack of a better word, leaned out the window and told him, "You can't chase me."
Wow.
And just took off down the street. And, you know, my buddy was like, yeah, he's right. We can't chase him.
Yeah, but now
and
we
I
can't.
Know myself
have, and, yeah, there's talk now of no foot chases in Chicago.
Well, that's what you just said. It's like Naked Gun. Hey, what are you doing? You can't chase me. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I can't chase you. All right. Well, have a good day. Let us
exactly.
know when you stop committing crimes.
Yeah, and if I remember right, I think in Chicago, isn't it that you have to call and get your supervisor's
yes,
permission?
Yes, that's what our mayor said. That's what she wants to have happen, but that's not
or LeBron.
The rule of law.
You get to, or LeBron. LeBron James can also give you permission
right.
to engage
in. Well, that's, yeah, I've seen that then. Yeah, because he's a good basketball player, so he knows law enforcement.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Steve, yeah, I just want to ask you real quick, because I know you were there front row seat for the Chaz Zone. As a police officer, how did that make you feel?
Yeah, that was really disgusting. You know, I'm retired now, but I worked in that precinct for over 20 years.
Wow.
And in that whole area. And just, you know, it really was a heartbreaking thing to see because it didn't have to happen. Chief Carmen Best wanted to do the right thing. You know, she was a sergeant of mine, you know, probably 20 years ago. And she's a very good woman. She was a good leader. And that's why they forced her out, basically, because she refused to stop being a cop. And she would not have let that happen. She was basically ordered to give up that precinct and to leave. And then she finally, you know, leave the area. And she finally left the department when they were going to force her to fire 100 cops. She just said, no, I can't do it. And so that's what they're doing. I mean, they force out, how often are you going to get a black female chief who's from the department that she's going to lead, and she's got the support of the police union and the community activists. You know, that's a magic thing, but that wasn't even good enough for the city of Seattle.
Mm. I kind of interrupted, but I did want to go back to the broken windows and whether
yeah.
or not things like graffiti or, I don't know, sofa beds and refrigerators and half of cars strewn on the sides of roads going in and out of major cities, like is the case in Chicago, and low-level retail theft and quote-unquote, you know, self-regarding criminal activity like prostitution or drug use. What does that stuff matter when it comes to policing? Can you have a safe city if you ignore all of those things?
You absolutely can't, because it's still against the law. You know, I mean, the laws exist. Police officers swear to uphold the laws, and then they're told not to uphold the laws. And even if they do, either the city prosecutor or the county prosecutor is going to kick it back and say there, you know, not enough evidence, or they declined it for whatever reason they make up. You know, and that's what's happening. And, you know, Seattle is like Chicago as far as what you're describing. You know, we've got the tent cities everywhere. It's garbage is everywhere. People committing crimes all over the place. I got a friend of mine who's a police officer, still lives in the city, one of the few officers that probably lives inside the city. And his wife is repeatedly harangued or harassed at the bus stop while she's waiting to go to work.
Okay.
And they're getting fed up, and as soon as he retires, they're probably going to leave the city. And that's happening a lot. We've got so many people, so many officers that have just had enough and have either retired if they could or resigned or lateral to other more cop-friendly departments.
Because the story out of New York City in the Giuliani era was cleaning up Times Square and police leadership that took graffiti and vandalism as seriously as more serious crimes because it's all on a continuum. And is that just sort of an apocryphal tale that police tell, or is that real? Is that like real criminology backed approach to policing, such that you, if you don't do the little things, you're not going to be successful at the big things?
Yeah, it's real, because if you look at the statistics in New York from that time period compared to beforehand, you see the real differences that they make, and it matches the anecdotal evidence that you, when you talk to people who lived there at the time, it matches. And what the thing is when you have laws that are on the books, and even if they're, you know, the lower level quality of life laws, they're important. And there's a reason they call them quality of life, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, you think about it, you pay taxes and you can't go to the park on the corner because they're allowing people to camp out there. In Seattle recently, they have one right here next to a school, and there's a samurai sword that's just stuck in the ground right over there. There's needles everywhere. And yet, for some reason, these local prosecutors, so-called prosecutors, are calling these survival crimes, you know, because they're low level and they're what, the quote-unquote homeless folks are committing.
Right. You have to shoot heroin to survive. That makes sense.
Thanks.
Steve Pomper, author, freelance writer, retired Seattle police officer, the book, The Obama Gang, How Barack Obama, Through His Post-Presidency Foundation, Assembled, Launched, and Wages the New Assault on American Law Enforcement. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.